Hey, everybody. Fantastic episode of the Daily Bone podcast here. We discuss Yuga Labs selling their heavy metal and Legends of the Mara collection to Faraway. We discuss the action that we're seeing in the crypto and NFT market, specifically with Yuga Labs. And then we're joined by a very, very special guest, Nathaniel Whitmore, the host of the Breakdown podcast. That's NLW. You may know him by that name. We talk about the Bitcoin ETFs, the Ethereum ETFs, the Bitcoin cycle, geopolitics, the kind of difference between MicroStrategy stock versus Coinbase stock versus mining stocks. We dive into a whole bunch of topics with him. It's incredibly informative, very information dense. Hope you enjoy the show. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thursday, April 18th, you have tuned into the Daily Bone podcast, your source for hot takes on the crypto markets, including Bitcoin, Ethereum, altcoins like Solana and AVAX, and of course, meme coins and NFTs. We have an absolutely jam-packed episode today. Very special guest, Nathaniel Whitmore, his first time coming on this show. I have interviewed him in the past. Let's make sure everyone in the comments gives him a very warm welcome when he comes on. It's awesome to have guests that are macro experts that are super, focused on the big picture stuff that's going on. He is the host of the Breakdown podcast, which is one of the best 15-minute daily breakdowns that you could listen to in the world, quite frankly, when it comes to Bitcoin and macro news. So very excited to have him on the show. Today, we're going to be discussing, before he comes on, Yuga Labs selling their heavy metal and Legends of the Mara collection to Faraway. That was a pretty significant news event if you are paying attention to the NFT market. That came out yesterday. CyberKongs, which is an OG Ethereum NFT collection, getting into Ordinals and Runes. And like I mentioned, we will be joined by NLW to talk all things Bitcoin and macro in 2024. Want to give a quick shout out to a longtime listener, Antoine Algin, who is a very talented AI artist who is doing a mint on Solana today. It's a generative collection, very low supply, like that 256 supply. The allowless one starts at 9:15. The allowless two starts at 10:15. Public 45 minutes later at 11 a.m. Eastern time. Anyone can buy for a quarter of a Solana. I like the pricing. I like the supply. The artwork's looking dope too. So big shout out to Antoine Algin. Dare I say it, I think this one's selling out. 256 supply, 0.25 sold price, dope AI, generative artwork. Love to see it. Shout out to Antoine, all the way from Greece, if I'm not mistaken. Almost positive it's Greece itself, not Cyprus or one of those nearby countries. Big W there for Antoine. Best of luck. Break a leg. Love to see it. Rook, what's that sound? What's that sound?
That's a plane.
Okay. Wow, it was a loud-ass plane. Today's show is brought to you in partnership with Honeyland. You heard an interview with the CEO of Honeyland on this show last week. Honeyland is the mobile game powered by the HXD token. That's ticker HXD. Easy. What do people need to know about Honeyland and how the game is powered by this token?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple things with HXD that you want to kind of understand first. The entirety of the gameplay is based on HXD. It's their in-game currency, and you can use it in the app right now to purchase in-game items, additional collectibles and NFTs, so new characters, the breeding mechanics to get more bees, upgrading the bees, spending it on missions to have better success rates, activities, and other mini-games as well, all within it, to just improve the experience. So when you're going on battles, when you're sending them on these active missions, if you want to get an edge on that, using the HXD token can give you that opportunity. And on top of this, they have a massive HXD airdrop that's starting May 10th. And right now, you can take advantage of that by getting to level 15 in the game, downloading it right now. If you have a Bodogos, you actually get a multiplier as well. And all of that is to get more HXD token. That's what the airdrop's in. And by getting to level 15, that's a way that you can maximize that opportunity beforehand and maximize the potential HXD that you earn. To get to level 15, it may just require some HXD to actually streamline that and speed up the process. So you can take action, picking up some NFTs, picking up some HXD to then leverage in-game for all the various mechanics that they have. But it seems like right now, that's probably the best course of action to take advantage of what's going down with the HXD token, with Honeyland, and their ongoing airdrop campaign that's kicking off in less than a month.
I'd love to see it. People really enjoyed hearing from the CEO, Clemente. Something to add here?
Only other thing I'll say is we're giving
you're on the wrong mic, big dog. Yeah, and the plane was outside your house, I'm going to bet.
100%.
100%. Mm-hmm. All right. Am I good now?
Now you're good. The only other thing I'll say is we're giving away $100 in the HXD token. All you need to do to figure out how to enter, it's pinned up at the top. Go enter. People are should be pretty good odds. All you need to do is download the game, post a picture of your account. We got a bunch of Bodagos playing this game and leveling up, which is awesome to see.
Love to see it. Bodog is always just getting after it, just scrappy, getting in here on Honeyland. Very well received when the CEO came on the show. Also loved his camera and microphone setup. Little note there for any other CEOs of little, whatever companies you're the CEO of. Have some decent broadcasting equipment if you're going to be doing press. Love to see it. Click the link in the tweet pinned to the top of the space or in the YouTube chat to download Honeyland and start leveling up your bees to qualify for the ticker HXD airdrop. Love to see it. NFTs and games. It's a match made in heaven. It's not going anywhere. It's how normies are going to figure out that NFTs aren't actually dead, despite literal multi-million dollar volumes on a daily basis. That's what it's going to take to have them figure it out. Anyway, let's dive into this weather report. We got a lot to cover in 19 minutes before the one and only NLW joins the show. Sig, please. Take it away.
Let's take it away then. If we've only got 19 minutes, it's Thursday, April the 18th. That ETH market volume is at 18 million. Solana at 7.5. Ordinals pulled back to 22. Onto the market leaders on the Ethereum side is actually Yuga Assets that have done extremely well with the V1 CryptoPunks. They're up 50% to 2.1 ETH. And Mutants are also back over 2 ETH. Over on Solana, it's Bodagos. They're up 10% to 4.5 SOL floor. And Parcel is down another 15% to 4 SOL. Finally, on Ordinals, the Wizards of Order up 50% on the back of their Rune web app announcement, and Runestones are up 22% to 0.08 BTC. On a crypto roundup, it's really the majors. They pretty much have been flat for a second day, despite 165 million big Bitcoin ETF outflows. Bitcoin is at 62,800, ETH at 3,050, and SOL at 136. On the meme coin side, it's been pretty quiet, with most of them holding their range. Small cap winner of the day is Degen Chain coin all-time high. That's up 2x to 2.5 million. And larger cap movers include Bome, which is up 10%, and Mew, which is down 20% on the day. Over the past 24 hours, the top three stories were, firstly, Yuga Labs have sold their Heavy Metal and Legends of Mara NFT collection to Faraway, a gaming studio that partnered with Yuga for the development of Dookie Dash Unclogged. Faraway also acquired Yuga's chief gaming officer, Spencer Tuck, in the move. Yuga burned 4,295 heavy metal NFTs they held in their treasury, and a collection is currently sitting at 0.07 ETH. So bye-bye heavy metal. Next, Sam Altman-led WorldCoin announced World Chain, an EVM-compatible L1 blockchain that's going to integrate their world token. Verified world ID holders will receive gas allowance on the chain and have priority block space over the bots. The world token is down 1% on the day to a 48 billion fully diluted market cap. And then lastly, ETH native artist Coldy launched a new collection for $20 Ordinal Open Edition mint called Michael Saylor Decentral Eyes. It's closing today at 5 p.m. Eastern. He added gamified mechanics in which the largest holder will receive a one-of-one ordinal, and anyone holding more than 2,000 editions during the snapshot later in April will receive a special bidder's edition ordinal. Just over 1,500 have been minted so far. That is all for the weather report. It is back to you folks in the studio.
Fantastic weather report. As usual, Sig, here's some updates from the Daily Bone newsletter. It is emailed to anyone that subscribes at dailybones.com. First story, Prometheus pre-rune ordinal gets airdropped by CyberKongs and sees over Clemente. You didn't update the call sheet. You wrote XXX Bitcoin volume overnight. That's something that should have been updated, ladies and gentlemen. We'll
five and a half million. Apologies.
Dude. Are you going to make this mistake again? We just can't have that sort of stuff, man.
$5.5 million in volume.
I didn't even know. I thought Nick was like off doing something else. I didn't know he was literally poised and ready to get upset with Clemente over a minor type error. Anyway, next story. We love Clemente, ladies and gentlemen. No, he's not slipping. It was one little teeny weeny thing. He's actually absolutely crushing it. Oh, Ray. Ray coming in with slack. He goes, that's on me. Sorry. That's that accountability that we have from people.
That's putting the pack in front. That's that dog mentality. That's oh my God, man. This shout out, Ray.
Easy forgot what our values are. He's like, that's putting the dog in front of the cat.
All right, Nick, name off the values right now, all five. Quick.
He can. He can. You can name the values. He can name them easy. He's
buying. Don't type.
I saw the mouse
type.
Move.
Don't type.
He knows the values.
I saw that. I saw the eyes. I saw the eyes flicker and the mouse move.
Mentality.
I saw the eyes flicker and the mouse move.
There's no flickering.
No, I saw the twinkle in your eyes.
There's no flickering.
I saw the move of the mouse. You can see the hand.
I can see the reflection of the Google logo in his eyes right now.
I've had enough of this, Easy, this lack of knowledge about what all of the values are and having them memorized. Well, obviously, we knew that content is king, leading with integrity, wag your tail, and pursue the impossible. I knew that.
Yep.
I actually will give this to Nick, even if he didn't remember it, because so Nick, I feel like, does know them. He just has not a great memory. And so I'll just give him a pass on that. Is that fair, Nick?
So what you're saying is he's old.
I didn't look him up on the computer. I'm just gonna straight up say that there's no evidence. So there's no evidence.
Fair enough. Well, anyway, we're gonna keep it moving. I think it's a good time to shout out.
I just say, Pio, that's the greatest excuse I've ever heard in the world. Like, imagine being in school saying that to your teacher. Like, I know the answers. I do. I just like they're there in my memory. I just kind of forgotten them in the moment. I like the way you move.
Like Blate over here just quoted me. He knows them. He just doesn't know them. You know, that's a fair way to put it. I think if you knew Nick, if you work with Nick, I think you'd understand what I'm getting at here. Is that
values are an expression of me. Like, I want to be clear that basically, so I'm already living the values. I live it so much. It's like basically asking a fish to describe water. Like don't ask the fish to do that. You may ask the fish to solve complex mathematical formulas and equations. That's something that you can ask a fish to do. But what you don't ask the fish about water.
Well, there you go. You don't ask a fish about water because its whole life is built around water. Anyway, moving through these Daily Bone updates so that we can get to the first story. The NBA Top Shot auction for the first ever one-of-one Victor Wembanyama, Wemby, ultimate rookie moment concluded with a winning bid of $145,000. Dare I say it, NBA Top Shot took the right approach here and did a one-of-one rookie moment. Easy knows better than me about Top Shot. Easy, are they going to go and put out 50 more now? Like, 100%. I just feel, dude, 100%. I feel like they're crack addicts, and now they're like, we just got 145K revenue event. Let's go do it 20 more times, baby.
But that's like the thing is that one of one moment sold less than some of the LeBron moments that have sold during peak. Like, you had $250,000 sales pretty consistently on some stuff. So seeing it go for 145K is like kind of sad. Like, that's like feels low.
Yeah, and I feel like, the trust has been broken with Top Shot, right? So I kind of feel like 145K for a Top Shot card now is actually still good just because the trust was broken, and this is where they rebuild. Anyway, moving on, Wizards of Ord creator Lifo FIFO, that's his name, Lifo FIFO, Lifo FIFO, okay? Announces, he just gives me a thumbs up like, yeah, that's his name. Announces Rune Blaster web app that will allow Xverse wallet users to efficiently mint runes without requiring any Bitcoin node setup. This is initially going to be available to Wizards of Ord holders. So all you deep tech people, that story's for you. Next one, claims for Jack Butcher's Oviators go live as the collection floor sits at 0.125. Dude, this is the very stylish sunglasses that Jack Butcher made. I was smiling and laughing just because of how hype this photo is. I always love it when NFT related things are kind of presented as like ultra cool. You know what I mean? Because it's like the nerdiest type of industry. And then it's like, yeah, but check out this extremely cool thing. Very cool sunglasses, though, nonetheless. Next,
Easy, you got some, right?
I redeemed them yesterday.
Heyo, let's go. You got to rock them when you get them.
Cool sunglasses. Sig, did you get these?
No, I didn't get them. I didn't get them, but I'm keen to see how they look like because the way this guy's flexing them, I feel like I'm not ready for summer. I feel like I'm missing a pair of Oviators right now. Easy, you need to wear them when they come.
There you go. Last story. Ord.io, an Ordinal Explorer launched by Leonidas, raised $2 million in pre-seed funding led by Bitcoin Frontier Fund and Sora Ventures. Yep. Congratulations to Leonidas. Let's go. $2 million in the bank. Everyone else is raising $9 million. I don't know what happened, Leonidas. No, I'm just kidding. He probably only wanted to raise that much. Very cool to see more venture investment in the Ordinals ecosystem on Bitcoin. Love to see it. Pre-seed raise $2 million, ord.io by Leonidas. The man's cooking. Some upcoming mints. You heard us talk about some upcoming mints last time, and one of them absolutely cooked. These are not sponsored. These are just what Ray and Clemente are researchers are seeing in the market. So in addition to the Coldy mint that was mentioned in Signal's weather report, two other Ethereum native artists have drops today that we'd like to quickly highlight. A Bright Spring Day by Grant Yun. You've heard of Grant Yun. This is his first Solana drop. It's a 250 edition collection on Solana via Art Launchpad Exchange.art. Mint price and exact time are TBD, but they're happening when? Like in the next week or so, Clemente?
I couldn't tell you. Couldn't tell you.
Okay, well, this is going to be very interesting because this is an established, ultra-successful Ethereum artist that the market really, really has liked dropping on Solana. And for a long time, Ethereum art collectors were like, they'll never do, you know, art will never be on Sol. It's not for Sol. And I never really like understood that. I'm like, what do you mean? It's just a different blockchain. Quite frankly, it's a better blockchain when it comes to transactions. I can't wait to see what happens here. Clemente?
Kath Simard was the first one.
Kath Simard.
Simard. Apologies.
The French. Clement, Nick, come in with this French pronunciation real quick, Nick. Can we get it, Nick? Is that possible?
That was absolutely just offensive.
Just call her Hottie. Everyone knows she's super hot. Just call her the Hottie Collection. Come on, guys. Let's not. She's super hot.
How dare you talk about her physical appearance what? Despite her posting it on a regular basis, her athletic.
She's the Angelina Jolie of the artist space in Web3. Let's just say it. And she her collection did very well in Solana, actually. So.
Signal. Well, this is not how we refer to talented artists that are crushing it in the art market. We're not what? Like
yeah,
what?
She's a hottie. We're like, come on, can we just all admit she's a hottie? Look, at the end of the day, all PFPs are always like long hair, massive boobs. It's always in our face. So let's just call a spade, and Kathy is hot. Anyway, back to the art, Grant Yun on Solana. Look out for that, guys. Obviously, it's gonna be one that's probably gonna be in demand. So watch it. Watch the secondary for that.
Wow. Well, I did not expect that to be discussed on the
rest, Pio. Actually, I've been thinking about these a lot recently. Just a huge fan. So there's a lot of things I've been thinking about, and a lot of my analysis on the market is based on the breasts of the tweeter.
Okay. And what are your findings?
That there's two of them?
Astute observation sake.
I seem more compelled to react to tweets with breasts. I don't know. It's weird. It's like this weird thing. So I've had to stop checking Twitter. It's ridiculous. It's gotten out of control.
People are weighing in. Someone said, good take, Nick. I love to see it. Anyway, moving on, we got A Bright Spring Day by Grant Yun. We'll see what happens there. Then we have Everyday Sats by DGen Alfie. So this opens at noon Eastern time today and is a generative pixelated PFP mint with a supply of 54.91 and a price of 0.003 Bitcoin. Alfie has announced that he has been leading a team in stealth building an art platform powered by Culture, ticker CLTR token that will be available to Everyday Sats holders shortly after the mint. So we will have to see how this one does. Different flavor here, 54.91 supply, but a low price, even though 0.003 Bitcoins is actually relatively high. See Clemente smirking over there. What are you smiling about, Clemente?
Just the comments are getting to me. Some good stuff today. Sorry. Let's keep going.
How about you highlight them real quick?
Just the research one.
Okay. All right. Okay. Anyway, look, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be joined by a very special guest in a few minutes. NLW, Nathaniel Whitmore, a host of the Breakdown Podcast. We should quickly cover Nick, something to add here.
I'm just wondering what's his breast situation.
Okay. Faraway acquired Yuga Labs gaming assets. So if you are an NFT person, this is about as big of a story as you can get in the NFT space. Yuga Labs has now sold all heavy metal and Legends of the Mara assets to gaming studio partner Faraway. And it's burned 4295 heavy metal assets that Yuga was holding themselves. So Faraway will own the following collections: heavy metal, sewer passes, other side vessels, other side Maras, and other minor collections involved in the other side game, with the exception of the codas themselves. Also, Yuga's chief gaming officer, Spencer Tucker, will transition to the Faraway team as their chief product officer. So a little aqua hire right there. Easy, you tweeted that you're a huge fan of the move on Twitter yesterday. Could you elaborate? It looks like Nick has something to weigh in with as well.
I think it's good for both parties involved. It kind of lets Yuga get rid of some assets that they were clearly not hyper-focused on. And Faraway was building these out regardless. They were helping with Dookie Dash Unclogged. They've been helping build out Heavy Metal and the Legend of the Mara game as is. So them taking it under their umbrella and kind of now being able to focus entirely on this, I think it's a big win for both parties. Faraway now gets the community aspect of these holders. They can iterate on the gameplay. They've been iterating on the gameplay. They've been working with everybody essentially on the Yuga side for these rollouts, including all the Dookie Dash stuff that they've been reworking on. So this feels like such a no-brainer for both parties. Now Yuga can undo some of the countless NFTs that they've introduced into the ecosystem, and Faraway can do what they've been doing well, which is gaming, including things like Serum City for Mutant Hounds, Dookie Dash, Mini Royales on Solana, and more.
Love to hear. I want to hear what Nick thinks. Clemente, I saw a tweet by King Blackboard, if you could pull it up, celebrating the move. He's a friend of the show. The thing is, I do disagree with the second half of his tweet. He celebrated this move and then said that Yuga Labs should do an airdrop or something like that. And someone just replied and was like, you mean right after they get rid of a bunch of assets in there? Yeah, so here we go. Yuga selling off their gaming arm today. Wise and bullish. Totally agree. Focus needs to be on BC, specifically on providing value and speculation hype for their club membership tokens, Bored Ape Yacht Club and Mutant Ape Club, Yacht Club. Now would be a perfect time to tease out an upcoming runes airdrop for their holders. And then scroll down to the first response, Clemente. Keep going a couple. Well, I mean, I think everyone's saying the same thing to him. Hotline Bling right there. Hotline Bling. They just got rid of one thing that was underperforming, and you want them to release another on-chain asset that will trend to zero. That's how I feel about it. I don't know. Nick, what's going on?
I like observing his post simply because that's the general vibe that everyone in the NFT space has, is give me another thing that's
for free.
Yeah, exactly.
That I can sell and then not worry about, and use that the money from the sale to gamble on something.
And then after I don't get something for a period of time, let me just complain and shit on you about what the situation is. NFT people are like, because it's the most volatile asset, they're also the most volatile emotionally, like as individuals. So I think, like, when you're looking on the sort of what's your favorite movie, Pia, where it's three levels down, it gets unstable?
Inception.
They're your favorite movie, Say No More. And basically, I think Inception is a good description of the overall market, right? You got level one. I'm not even including crypto. We're just going to go stock market. Is it level zero? Level one is Bitcoin. Level two,
altcoins.
Yeah, we get altcoins. Level three,
meme coins.
Yeah. Level four, NFTs, basically. And so, like, when you're operating on that level, your life is at heavy risk of completely collapsing. And we see that in terms of the emotional stability of the people in this space. I think that it's interesting that I think Garga's approach makes sense. I think they have such a desperate need to have somebody. I think they need someone to run Bored Ape Yacht Club separate. Like, there really needs to be like a signal saying no. I'm going to be curious to hear her perspective on it as a non-holder. Look, this is someone who's been in the weed signal. So I want.
I'm going to do the PO thing. No, finish your thought. Finish your thought.
I think that the Bored Ape Yacht Club has not received enough love, and everyone's now saying the silence strategy is not working now. because people haven't been airdrop money for a period of time. It's just like you can't win with holders and separately. I feel for them to a degree. I also, the whole gaming thing is completely irrelevant to me and irrelevant to the NFT space as far as I'm concerned. Like, it's just not something. Pudgy has an element of that. They're talking about building a metaverse. To me, that's just crazy. Like, they're like, it's not something that the after they announced it, actually, it does work for a moment. Everybody in this space, when Other Side first came out, all the Bored Ape people are like, yo, they're going to just absolutely crush it. They're going to absolutely dominate it, man. This is game changing for the Bored Ape Yacht Club and everything else. Same people 6 months later. What the fuck is going on? You go, what's going on? We knew you were building a AAA game, but like, why isn't it out already? Even though it takes 5 years to produce something like that. Why isn't it out? Why is the price down? Why have you abandoned us? What the hell is taking place here? Do you guys even work? Like, there's all sorts of like, it just completely shifts all of a sudden, which is why I think the best thing is actually not to do something like that, not to go build the game. They should just focus on Bored Ape Yacht Club, honestly, like, and just build out. They have a whole like, last thing on this signal where you were arguing for not. Bored Ape Yacht Club did a pretty bad job with merch, I would say, overall. Yet
did a good job at first.
Yeah, yet they had this like opportunity in front of them to build out this Bored Ape Yacht Club brand that was cool. And then they went and did the least cool thing possible. Gaming, I'm sorry, gamers. Not the coolest group of people usually. Like,
it's not that cool.
Gamers and nerds, which is hilarious that gamers hate on NFTs because we're both geeks. Yes. Like, this is both a geeky group of people, yet the gamers hate on NFTs, which is just a whole other problem. But why did Bored Ape Yacht Club have what was perceived as cool for a moment, go and say, you know, the least cool thing we can do? Let's go fucking tackle that for a period of time and just work on that. I don't know. I think there were all sorts of like issues being done. They need someone to run it. And they need someone. I think what that demonstrates is the DNA of the founders were not inherently cool. I know that I could disagree with like Gordon, for example, is cool in the NFT space, But the guy's like a book nerd, right? Like he's like an ultimate, like,
which is perfect for, you know, crypto and NFTs. Like, he's perfect for it. Yeah.
But also, Nick, it was specifically this geeky nerd DNA that brought apes to where they were. And the reason why I don't think they need someone is because they need this DNA. If you've ever worked at a startup and it was really cool and it was an amazing place to be and the leaders knew what they were doing and the company does really well, and then they go and bring in this other CEO, because this is very common that they'll have the founder who'll take the company, for 5 or 7 years, whatever. And then when it gets to a certain point, you need to bring in a different skill set to take the company to the new level. And that is what they exactly they did, but it didn't go in the direction that they wanted it to, hence why Daniel has left and hence why all these gaming assets have been sold off. Now they need to go back to the drawing board, look at what it was, what is the ethos of that company that made it special at that time. The two founders are key and crucial to getting this right. They need to just go back to the drawing board and sort of flesh out what that was and bring those ideas to life. But I really do believe that the only people who can do that are the founders. And once they have sort of empowered the community with their trust again, then you can bring new people in. But bringing some random person in again is not what the club needs.
They could buy like a clothing company or something like that, frankly, like for $20 million or something like that. Like, get a legit clothing company, streetwear brand, whatever it is, and just be like, that's ours now. Like, there's all sort. I don't know. I feel like there's so many opportunities. It would also give them.
You can't buy culture is the thing. That's like, if you bought a streetwear company, you watched it with Supreme when LVMH bought them out, which was like Louis Vuitton money.
LVMH
bought them out. Everyone bitched about it because they felt like it just killed the culture, which was like, honestly, part of kind of what a lot of people said with BAYC here was like, they ended up raising a ton of capital from VCs, and it was like, oh shit, the culture is gone. And that's like part of what made them apes. It was like them joining clubhouse rooms and making ape noises for literally 8 hours a day. And it was fun. It was like during COVID, it was all this stuff going on. And then it kind of just felt like it got more into a traditional corporation vibe.
Well, you know, it's good to hear the kind of analysis on what's going on with Bored Ape Yacht Club. We're going to shift gears to the macro side and the Bitcoin side a little bit here. We have a very special guest, the host of the Breakdown Podcast. I sincerely recommend that you listen to this podcast if you want daily updates on what is going on in the world of crypto, macro, and of course, Bitcoin. We have Nathaniel Whitmore, NLW. NLW, welcome to the show, man.
What's going on, guys?
Not much.
Nice to have me back.
Oh, of course. Well, you haven't been on this show. You're on the Bitcoin focused podcast, but we're excited to have you here. Before we dive into the Bitcoin ETF, before we dive into the cycle, macro, geopolitics, what is your impression of Bored Ape Yacht Club? I'd be curious.
From the outside, so as someone who sort of like passively engages with it, I think actually it's pretty reflective of the broader NFT space, where so you had this huge explosion at the beginning of last cycle, right? And the thing that NFTs did, which was totally unique in the history of crypto, is for the first time there was an audience that was totally disconnected from other digital assets that came in and got passionate about a part of the space. That's really profound, right? An entirely new category of influencers who didn't give a crap about Bitcoin or Ethereum or anything else, really. And so the question was always going to be, when the cycle sort of, you know, peeled off and fell over, what was going to happen? I think that for a little while, NFTs looked way more resilient than I think anyone would have given them credit for, right? And even as prices fell, you still had a lot more folks who really did sincerely care about the communities that they were a part of than I think people would have given it credit for, right? And so my perception has been that a lot of the last, call it year and a half, has been a rebuilding period from the base of sort of like the core parts of communities who cared throughout and were sort of trying to rebuild whatever the next version of those things was going to be. I think Bored Apes, because they were at the apex of everything, because they had sort of like the biggest, you know, infiltration in some ways into pop culture, are sort of broadly reflective of that. And so the sort of chaos around them is probably, you know, heightened relative to, you know, another collection where it didn't have sort of the pressures of the outside. So I don't know. I think the question is for almost all of these communities is where the next source of new energy is going to come from, you know, what the reasons for it are. And, you know, I just sort of peeled into the last little bit of the conversation around, you know, bringing back founder energy and, you know, hold aside even founders. I think whatever it was that made a community special at the beginning tends to be the thing that gets lost as it gets big and commercialized, and is often the thing that can bring it back, at least on a foundational level. So I don't know. I'm rooting for a lot of these communities to sort of figure out, you know, what they are and where they want to be in the future, because they were, like I said, I think a lot more meaningful for people than a lot of people, you know, cynically would have given them credit for last cycle.
Absolutely. And before we kind of dive into the sort of Bitcoin cycle stuff, the macro stuff, one follow-up question on this. When I spoke with you last time, you talked about kind of seeing in the future the potential of these different communities with NFTs. If you had to make a bet on how just the broad kind of NFT landscape shapes, you know, kind of shakes out, given what you know about crypto, Bitcoin, and digital assets, how could you see this kind of playing out like long-term? Is it a video game angle? Is it just online communities like Reddit style? How do you see it going?
The biggest unknown that we have when it comes to the future of entertainment is how, not to be the guy that intersects AI with everything now, but like at what AI is going to do from an entertainment perspective is create the capacity for radically more creation, right? There's just going to be so much more content that can be created. And one of the pathways that could lead to is much more personalized content where, you know, I'm just living in, I don't know, Witcher fan fiction forever because like that's my preferred area or whatever. And I don't have to care that much about the fact that some big Hollywood studio hasn't done that, or like I didn't like Netflix casting of the new guy because, you know, it's just AI is creating it for me. So this is one version of that. But the you know, you can start to see this world in which You know, the consumptive content gets way more diversified. The game style content gets way more, you know, in-depth, interesting, you know, spread across lots of things. So I think that the gaming and entertainment piece feels like an obvious area where this goes, but not in a way that's just a one-to-one replication of sort of entertainment and gaming as we think about it now, but is actually like, I can see these communities being at the forefront of some of those experiments in, you know, what more generative type gaming, what more generative type entertainment can actually be, because all of a sudden, sort of this like rich set of IP and characters and things have more of a context that can seed all of that stuff. So I think the things that people have thought were going to be a place for this in the long run, I think is right, but maybe in a very different manifestation than we might have imagined sort of pre-ChatGPT.
Well, it's really hard to predict, that's for sure, and appreciate the insight on that. If we shift gears to Bitcoin, we're now about 100 days in to the Bitcoin ETFs trading. And at this point, you know, last time I spoke with you, we were discussing how even the most bullish scenario before the ETFs were trading wasn't bullish enough, right? But now at this point, we're not seeing the same $500 million of inflows every single day anymore. What do you make of the current state of affairs with the Bitcoin ETFs and Bitcoin's price action in general?
There was always going to be a period at which the narrative ran out of steam from like an energetic perspective, right? So I think that there's sort of a gloom that's descended upon everyone a little bit, which is, you know, to be expected. But if you take a step back and you had assumed going into sort of like the ETF hype cycle the excitement around that, the new inflows that were going to come from that in an immediate kind of burst kind of way, were going to take the price of Bitcoin to some sort of level. I don't think many people would have predicted as high as it got. You know, I think a lot of people would have optimistically thought maybe 50, maybe 60, you know, maybe like inching up and hitting all-time highs, but certainly not staying there for meaningful periods of time. And so I think that it's outperformed from the standpoint of what most people, again, going back 6 months, would have thought was a likely pop from that both that narrative excitement and also like whatever the new inflows are. Now, what's left now that excitement has dissipated, now that there are not sort of like big groups of inflows, is a question of where new inflows are going to come from. You know, are there going to be you know, entirely new categories of buyers? Or is Bitcoin now caught up in the larger malaise that's gripping markets as it becomes clear that we're not going to get the sort of rate cuts that, you know, the market was planning on? Like, you have to remember sort of bringing in the macro side that when ETFs sort of hype got started, markets were pricing in like 7 rate cuts this year. That's why risk assets were, you know, or that was a foundational piece of why risk assets were starting to come back in a big way. Now at this point, we're like barely pricing in 1, and it doesn't really seem like there's any good reason to even have that if you're the Fed. And so there's been a natural sort of pullback in general of risk assets. And so it may be, and this is an important thing to keep in mind, like the lack of new inflows could literally just be the entire sort of market recalibrating on how much they should be putting into sort of their risk allocation. Now, there's a whole separate question about whether Bitcoin is a risk on or risk off asset. That's a really interesting one that we can get into in general. But I would say that like, as we bring in more folks who are in the traditional markets, they're going to be viewing Bitcoin initially as a risk on asset. If they're not sort of fully converted and they're just viewing it as part of their portfolio composition, it's going to firmly be in that risk on category. And so when the market goes risk off, that's going to impact Bitcoin too.
And when you talk about Bitcoin risk on versus risk off, are you referring to, I guess, traditionally Bitcoin singularly being categorized as a risk on asset, but maybe post Silicon Valley Bank, for example, maybe now the market could start to see it as a risk off asset? Because in my mind, it's a risk off asset, but yeah. I don't think the broader market thinks that.
For those of us over here, it is like the ultimate risk off asset, right? But a lot of people, whatever portion of their crypto stash they keep in Bitcoin is like the most risk off of the things that they do. Yeah. It's something that they have long-term conviction in. You know, they might even have separate categories of Bitcoin that are more or less risk off, right? They might have some that's on exchanges that they play around with, and then others that are on a ledger buried in their backyard for their kids' college, right? So for the crypto community, it's distinctly risk off. And for certain communities around the world that are dealing with, you know, higher rates of inflation and things like that, it's also more risk off. But if you're talking about a U.S. market composition and traditional actors who, again, who are just thinking about this as it sits next to stocks and bonds, it's very clearly a risk on asset. It's you know, on the farthest end of the risk spectrum for them. So part of what makes Bitcoin so fascinating from like a macro analysis standpoint is that it's not conveniently lumpable into any of these categories. And you kind of have to understand different buyers having different profiles and how that all mashes together.
Absolutely. And when we think about the Bitcoin cycle, and you pointed out, maybe people weren't expecting that the ETFs would actually drive Bitcoin to a new all-time high so fast. We now have an all-time high before the halving. When I spoke with Pete Rizzo a couple months ago, it was before this happened. And I said, I asked him, does that invalidate the kind of traditional Bitcoin cycle theory that we have? And he said, absolutely. If Bitcoin hits a new all-time high before the halving, then everything that we know about the Bitcoin cycles is now invalidated and we're in a brave new world. Do you agree with that? How do you think about Bitcoin cycles moving forward?
Ish. I agree with that ish. I think that for me, it's not as reliant on the single factor of hitting the all-time high, before the halving. Although, Rizzo's a really smart guy. I'm sure it's more nuanced for him as well. But I think that the ETFs made it so that we were already in new territory, right? This is a totally exogenous source of demand, of buying power, of market access that we've never had before in anything resembling this, that was always going to have an impact. And we saw it, right? We saw it in the fact about how moved up this cycle was in terms of some of these peaks. We have no idea now how much it actually has warped the cycle versus just compressed the cycle versus invalidated the cycle, right? So zoom out 2 years from now. And let's imagine that roughly speaking, what happens is we got to this new all-time high really fast. We sort of, then retraced for a while and around the halving, kind of stuck around this. And then, as that happened, other sectors of the crypto space kind of became more in focus. And then eventually there was, maybe 6-7 months down the line, a sort of a return. Maybe, we hit those all-time highs again. Maybe we go a little bit higher. And then we got to sort of slosh off back down to the bear cycle. Like, this seems like a not inconceivable thing to happen. And then all of a sudden we're exactly back in the cycle. It's just, it was moved up 6 months because of the force of the ETF. So I think it's really hard to know how much the cycle is actually broken. But I think that if we're being honest, the cycle is, we've had two roughly where anyone was paying attention to actually map this as a pattern. It was a very small amount of data. It just happened to sort of like reflect itself, two, three times. So, cycle theory is really interesting because it has this way of rationally seeming like it shouldn't make sense. And then irrationally, it just kind of keeps playing out in similar ways. But then you dig into those similar ways that it's played out and there's all these external factors which could have shaped it, so it's hard to say.
Incredibly hard to say. And, you talk about the lull before the halving, which is a kind of traditional, cycle characteristic. Do you think that got delayed because of how, excited the market was by the ETFs? Is that kind of what we're seeing here, that the lull's coming a little bit later, it's coming at, when the halving is actually happening? Is that, a fair kind of assessment?
Yeah, but remember too, the lull has also been after the halving. One of the things, and in fact, the biggest lull traditionally is after the halving, when people realize that there's not going to be some massive, instant increase in price. I think that the thing is, so my thesis on the halving has always been that the initial part, the more important part of it from a market driving perspective is narrative. The halving serves to reinforce and create context for media to remind the world of this unique property of Bitcoin, which is the fact of a fixed supply that reduces issuance over time until it gets to that fixed supply, which stands in such wild contrast to every other asset. This was the story in 2020 in a big way, right? We got Paul Tudor Jones' great monetary inflation thesis. And right as we were cranking up the COVID money printer, that's when the Bitcoin halving happened last time. It was a hugely narrative moment, a moment of realization. Now that translates then into other people paying attention and all of the sort of actual supply dynamics in terms of issuance can start to take hold. But initially, it is a kind of a narrative driver. And so the question will be, I think, following this halving, will there be things going on in the world where the halving like really reinforces how unique it is? And that's sort of hard to see. That's based on the rest of the world. That's not based on Bitcoin.
Yeah, we'll have to see how it plays out. If I'm remembering the numbers correctly, Paul Tudor Jones at that side had at that time had a iconic quote to me, which was he said he liked Bitcoin better at 14K than he did at 4K, which I thought was really cool to hear, you know, a big time investor like him say. Moving on to the kind of geopolitical side, we have a tweet from Fred Krueger. I know that you reference Fred Krueger from time to time on the breakdown. He's definitely a Bitcoin permabull, but he kind of points out the history of global conflict and how it relates to asset prices. How do you think about the current global conflict situation in relation to not only Bitcoin, but risk assets in general, the stock market, just macro in general? I'd love to hear how you're thinking about this.
It's really hard. So I think that the obvious truth that underlies Fred's tweet here is markets hate a lack of clarity more than they hate even thing like bad things that are clear, right? So we dislike it when we don't know what's likely to happen next, you know, from a market perspective, more than when the situation becomes clear and even if it's unpreferable, right? And so, you know, in these moments where the drone strike happens and there's really big questions around, is this going to escalate further? Is the U.S. going to be dragged in? What are the sort of dominoes that might fall here? Is this really like, are these two actors, these two geopolitical actors, both have an incentive to kind of create like a fake war to draw in their allies? Like there's all of these interesting, you know, kind of questions that are extremely unclear with a massive band of things that could happen next because of that. That's what markets hate because they don't know how to bet. They don't know where to move. They don't know, you know, like markets are very good at moving from one category of assets to another or sort of hedging different types of risks unless they don't know what types of risks they're supposed to be hedging. And that's sort of what happens in those liminal moments. As things get clearer, it becomes easier. You know, it's not necessarily that it's good for markets. I don't think it's quite that clear. It becomes easier for markets to digest and make decisions. So really these liminal in-between moments where everything is scary and unknown are the most challenging moments, I think for investors.
Absolutely. And speaking of challenges, you know, you've been talking about the altcoin markets on your podcast a little bit recently, and a lot of people are paying attention to just how hard altcoins got hit, even compared to Bitcoin during this dip, the lack of conviction that people might have in altcoins, and they're just trading them to try to make some sort of gain, some sort of profits. How do you look at the altcoin markets right now, whether it's Solana, Ethereum, you know, any kind of altcoins, how are you thinking about them?
So it's been this way for a while, but altcoins is this legacy term that is too big for its own britches in a lot of ways. You know, like do people really consider Solana, for example, in the same category as, I don't know, dog with hat coin or whatever. Most people don't. Now, you know, Bitcoiners who have their like clear conviction in one area do, and that's fine. And that's sort of where the genesis of this is from. But I think broadly speaking, most people don't. They sort of distinguish these things. And so I think that maybe a better distinction in terms of some of these dynamics are like conviction coins and non-conviction coins,
sure.
Right?
Yep.
And so, you know, this is one of the big notable aspects of this cycle has been the extent to which Solana beat out the worst predictions of how it was going to go. That was a big part of the excitement of this cycle was the resurgence of this, which was predicated on a community of builders who never abandoned it. And in fact, used the bear market to just like radically improve and expand the infrastructure, you know, for building in that area. So you have all those things. I think those are those sort of categories of assets are more likely to follow a traditional kind of Bitcoin altcoin relationship. I think that the biggest question mark is the random new stuff, these meme coins that are sort of like they're not a unique part of this cycle, but their presence from a discussion standpoint is certainly bigger in this cycle than they have been. And, you know, I don't know, is it really unexpected that these things which have like higher upside because they're like the craziest, most ridiculous game also have high, you know, more severe downside? Like it doesn't seem that crazy to me, you know, like if there's not enough capital floating around for to be playing that game, like people leave the game, you know?
Yeah, I don't think that, you know, I think meme coins is a less interesting conversation than conviction coins, as you're kind of describing them, like Solana, Ethereum. Nick, did you have a question for Nathaniel?
Well, yeah. First of all, do you trade at all, or like what's your sort of like investment? Like,
no, I am like a long term buy and hold. I'm terrible at trading. Would never even try to do it. So I have very few insights on that area.
And on the investing standpoint, so is that like, what does that look like in the crypto space? Is it primarily just Bitcoin?
It's primarily Bitcoin. I do some other things, but Bitcoin has always been my sort of long-term interest in the space.
When you say some other things, what does that look like?
The Ethereums and Solanas of the world. That's basically it.
Okay. So you're in, I mean, that's heavily and mostly my portfolio as well. I think everyone on this show kind of falls into a similar bucket. That said, we mess around a little bit on the degen side, buying into random trends and making and losing money simultaneously. It's an interesting balance of which, or debatable as to whether or not we're up or down at any given moment. The other thing I was just curious contextualizing is sort of like for our audience, what like, You, I know you have a podcast. Pio introduced you for having that podcast, but I'm curious, like, what sort of your, it's clear that you think long-term, what sort of your overall sort of bias angle, like, how would you describe sort of your overall sort of market approach and how you're, you approach it from the podcast standpoint? I'm just curious, like, what your overall perspective is.
For yeah, I mean,
analyzing you as a person.
Yeah.
In our audience.
Sort of with the crypto industry, like broadly speaking. I mean, I can give you the big, like my take on the entire industry in a few sentences, if that's of interest.
Yeah, let's do it. That's so, super helpful.
Awesome. So I think for me, the Bitcoin has always been obvious as this thing that needs to exist in this world, like this truly non-sovereign asset that is sort of a money or store of value system, whatever, you know, I don't even get into the debates about that, but this thing that you can kind of keep your wealth in outside of the purview of governments makes so much sense if you look across the world and like the percentage of people who operate in unstable monetary regimes. So this has always been obvious. Now, there's huge questions within Bitcoin in terms of, you know, how it evolves, how it grows, and, you know, there are lots of things. I think one of the things that has a lot of Bitcoiners excited is the dynamism around some of those discussions that's taken hold over the last 2 years compared to where it was like 4 years ago, you know? But by and large, from a base level standpoint, Bitcoin is this thing that sort of obviously needs to exist. Now, I think that there's this whole other category of things which seem and feel really opportune, which is sort of exemplified first by Ethereum and smart contracts, all these different ways that the financial plumbing can be like wired together in unique ways that don't involve the same sort of intermediaries. And then the ways in which some of those systems can also be reapplied potentially to other types of systems that aren't just monetary, right? There's been this sort of dream not only of decentralized finance, but also of decentralized other systems, decentralized social networks. Now, those things haven't matured in a way where they're clearly like they're not a force necessarily relative to the traditional centralized versions of things, right? We didn't have some explosion like people were thinking there was going to be in 2017, 2018 of, you know, competing, you know, Amazons or competing, you know, Facebooks or competing Instagrams that were decentralized. But I don't think that that's made the desire for those things any less. And so you have on sort of like some of the other chains, these two big categories of questions. As one is, can you rewire finance in a decentralized or more decentralized way? And then two, can you bring that to that energy to other areas? The reason that I think those things are, you know, as what I would say to Bitcoiners, for example, who find themselves completely uninterested in those things, I think that it's pretty easy for me to separate them from some of the core functions of Bitcoin and still view them as really important and interesting and potentially powerful experiments that could have hugely world-changing implications if they mature, if they sort of are able to compete. And so I think that a lot of the questions in those areas are, we don't know what the right combination of sort of, you know, decentralization, performance, like all of these things are the sort of set of trade-offs that people are kind of constantly jockeying for. Those things are interesting to me from that standpoint, especially because I think that as the world proceeds, power gets more, not less concentrated. You're seeing that now with AI. There's this interesting thing happening, I think, in the crypto space where there is, on the one hand, a cynical attempt to associate, you know, decentralization as sort of like, you know, in crypto and, you know, tokens that relate to to AI in some way. And that was always going to happen because crypto is very good. Web3 is very good at sort of having a token for any global theme that happens. But the non-cynical version of it is a recognition that like the power of big tech companies is increasing dramatically as this sort of important technology frontier is predicated upon access to compute, which only a very small handful of companies have. And could decentralized alternatives be a part of the answer that sort of helps society reconcile it? I think it's a really interesting question. So, you know, there's sort of like almost layers to me of product market fit, you could say, but all within a broader context of, I think, important and valuable goals for people to pursue that all sort of come down in some ways to people being able to interact with each other in various ways without sort of intermediaries, without gatekeepers, and without, you know, sort of people capturing the value in the middle.
Yeah, Nathaniel, I think that the hardcore Bitcoiners kind of singularly think of Bitcoin as money and almost ignore how robust the technology that Bitcoin brought into the world is and how it can be applied to other things. That's at least the way that I think about it sometimes, because, you know, most hardcore Bitcoiners are like, if it's not Bitcoin, it's bullshit. And I think that they only think about Bitcoin, you know, for its use case of, you know, long-term store value, institution, grade safe haven asset. You know, you can insert all these money and value related things, but like you're talking about decentralized social networks, I mean, I think that there is room for that. Obviously, they haven't gotten traction, like you pointed out. Nick, did you have any follow-up question on that? Otherwise, I wanted to dive into Ethereum a little bit.
I had a quick question there on
that. Oh, go ahead. Easy.
Yeah, just about, you had mentioned something with like big tech and just kind of like where it's shifting to. I guess this is kind of not so much about crypto, but just big tech in general and kind of it is about crypto. It's hand in the US markets and where you could see, like, do you believe that the US market will end up dominating in the cryptocurrency space? Or do you feel that that ends up shifting more offshore? Because even right now, like, we see Bitcoin price action heavily dictated by US equity markets. And I guess I'm curious if you think that there will be a decoupling there where it starts to shift more towards international markets.
It's really hard to say. So I would say, it is already more international than almost anything else. Like, the US markets are so unbelievably dominant in just about every area that the fact that crypto isn't uniquely dominant in that area, I think, is actually quite to its testament as this sort of global force. The fact that we can realistically have a conversation around whether, you know, Asia's driving things at any given moment, you know, how the Middle East plays in, like, these are things that you just, the scope of US markets in other asset areas is just so huge that it just doesn't come up, right? We remain the dominant, maybe not forever, but for right now. I think that scale from like a price standpoint is going to be very hard to overcome, right? Like, Bitcoin ETFs in the US are, you know, Hong Kong just approved
That's
a set of ETFs,
bring
for
up,
example.
Was like, yeah. The lack of price action we saw from an ETH and Bitcoin ETF in Hong Kong versus the US ETF, which literally sent it to all-time high.
But the Hong Kong ETF market is tiny compared to the US, right? Right, Nathaniel?
Yeah. So in every Hong Kong ETF, not just crypto, but every Hong Kong ETF all combined, has fewer assets than the Bitcoin ETFs in the US right now that are, you know, two months old or whatever. Just and Hong Kong is like not a small market. When we think of like big financial centers, you know, Hong Kong's, you know, near the top of the list. So it's just the scale is just so different.
Yeah. And speaking of Ethereum ETF here, so a lot of people are wondering, well, a lot of people were saying that it's a foregone conclusion that the Ethereum ETFs in the United States will not be approved in May. I mean, the experts like Eric from Bloomberg, James Safer from Bloomberg, I think their position, I haven't checked on it this week, but their position, I think, going into this week was that it's not going to get approved in May, but will probably get approved eventually. I'd love to know the impact in your mind of an approved Ethereum ETF, whenever we get that, on Bitcoin, on Ethereum, on conviction coins like Solana and others, AVAX, you know, altcoins, traditionally speaking, and then also on, you know, kind of the high risk assets like meme coins and NFTs. Like, how does an Ethereum ETF play into those?
Drags everything up from a price standpoint, is my feeling. And here's why. So I think that if you view sort of Wall Street and traditional finance as the set of folks, like the set of them who haven't come to some strong conviction one way or another about crypto, right? So let's ignore the people who are already in and are basically like us, and the people who are never going to be like us because they hate it, right? the vast majority of people who are in traditional finance or traditional investors fall in that middle space. So what would it mean to have a Bitcoin ETF and an Ethereum ETF, strictly from like a narrative standpoint for those folks? Well, it becomes pretty easy to see Bitcoin as getting proxy to the sort of deep store of value, non-sovereign money side of this industry, and an Ethereum ETF as a proxy for all of the interesting technology stuff, all of the smart contracts, all of the things that could be, right? So if you are an investor who just wants some exposure to the future, right, or a possible future, right? If you've handicapped the possibility that these things work at 10%, so you want some of it in your portfolio, because if it does work, it's going to be huge. You know, an Ethereum ETF and a Bitcoin ETF really represent a pretty big chunk of what you might be interested in. But I think that Bitcoin alone doesn't, right? It doesn't really give you access to all of the other stuff in crypto in a way that an Ethereum ETF would be a proxy for all that other stuff in crypto. I think that the impact of other ETFs after Ethereum will be dramatically less. Not necessarily on that specific asset, but like, let's say that Ethereum ETF was approved this year, and then, you know, a year and a half down the line, a Solana ETF was approved. I don't think that that third sort of, you know, leg of the stool would be anywhere near as impactful, because it's much more about the specific asset at that point rather than the sort of entire category of assets that it represents. I think an Ethereum ETF represents an entire category of assets, and so would have a disproportionate amount of interest because of that.
Bitcoin to a stock market investor is like the gold, and Ethereum is like the tech, so to speak, right?
Yep. I mean, and it sounds ridiculously reductive and oversimplified because it is, but like, if you're investing across 40 categories, like you're in the ballpark with that being your assessment, right? If you just want a little bit of exposure.
And when there's only two products on the market that you can even buy. I mean, obviously, you can talk about like Coinbase and MicroStrategy. Well, let's touch on those quickly, because I talked with you about those last time. And since then, both have done well. MicroStrategy has done incredibly well. I think a lot of people didn't expect that. I interviewed Dan Held and Fred Krueger around the same time that you and I last spoke. Both of them essentially condemned investing in either company. If I recall correctly, also mining stock. So I'd love to understand, how are you thinking about MicroStrategy stock here, Coinbase stock, with the advent of Base and the fact that Coinbase is custodying, I think, 8 out of the 11 US-based Bitcoin for the US-based ETFs. And then lastly, the mining stock seriously underperforming. How are you thinking about these three kind of assets or asset classes?
Sure. Let's do mining stocks first.
Sure.
My sense is that we're likely to get more sophistication in how mining stocks are handled going forward. I don't think we're there yet, because I don't think that people are paying all that much attention, because they just were able to get this exposure. But like, in a world where you don't have to proxy Bitcoin exposure, the reason that you would invest in these things becomes a little bit more traditional. Like, you're making an assessment around the company, right? So I think what you'll start to see after the halving is like a much stronger interest in, you know, what is the cost, you know, per Bitcoin mine? Like, what is the break-even level for these companies, right? Because there's a huge range in mining right now of how they can mine, you know, profitably. And those things probably should be more reflected in market prices than they are, right? There's a vast chasm between, you know, the best mining companies, quote unquote, and sort of the less good mining companies. I would expect over time, again, as people don't have to proxy, Bitcoin exposure with Bitcoin mining stocks, that the mining stocks start to reflect their actual position in the industry, as well as a little bit of overall where we are in the Bitcoin cycle. But for whatever reason, I don't think that that's happening yet. I think it's just, you know, again, there's been so much energy and emphasis on the Bitcoin ETF that I don't think that that's happened yet. MicroStrategy is the biggest question mark to me, in the sense that I'm not sure why the there's such a high premium to the, you know, the assets underneath. I do think that it reflects a stronger belief in the Saylor approach, right? I think it's reflective of that. I think that it probably reflects a sense that they'll continue to acquire, and that they're in a stronger position to keep growing that pie.
And no fee compared to the spot ETFs, right?
Yeah, I wonder to what extent, and I have no insight into whether this is the case, but I wonder to what extent some folks are still, you know, they don't really want to go straight to the ETF for whatever reason. Maybe they don't have a mandate yet. You know, like their broker isn't you know, offering that, but they still want exposure. And so, you know, MicroStrategy remains a decent proxy for them. You know, it wouldn't surprise me if that's the case. We're still very nascent. Just because the ETF is now available doesn't mean that a lot of, you know, diligence offices have said it's okay to invest in yet, right? There's this whole additional set of process which is going to take, you know, months, if not years to get fully on board with. And so maybe they're experiencing part of that pop. I would expect it over time to reconcile a little bit, you know, to be closer to sort of the net asset value of the underlying. But you know, who knows? Coinbase, I think, is sort of obvious when you look at it, why you would be interested in that alongside, you know, Bitcoin. I mean, this is for a very long time, there's an interesting debate around whether you would be better off just buying, you know, Bitcoin and having held it versus investing in these companies. But Coinbase at this point has proven itself to be one, not only an unbelievably resilient and well-run company relative not just to the crypto industry, but to other industries as well. It has continued to expand its revenue base. And, you know, the custody thing is obviously a big piece of that. You know, it's sort of taking advantage of the sort of shift. But, you know, the fees that are coming from Base are going to start attracting notice in ways that they haven't yet. And I think that Wall Street's going to get even more excited. You know, so Coinbase is a company that not only benefits from overall price appreciation in crypto and just what that means, you know, their core business of retail obviously gets better and better as that happens. But they've also like just they're adding business lines that could keep looking better and better. So I don't know. It's sort of transparently a really good company. And, you know, investors are never going to be as, you know, crypto investors are on the very extreme end of sort of thesis driven and willing to put all of their chips on a single, you know, pie. Like no one in the traditional world is like that. Like it just doesn't exist. You know, the fact that we like can have a rational conversation around like even which three assets most of us are invested in. That's like ludicrous, wild, right? Relative to other worlds. So, you know, of course, if you're excited about the Bitcoin ETF, you're going to be excited about Coinbase too right now.
Yeah. Crypto investors real quick. So crypto investors are literally down to put all their money on dog with hats. So that yeah. says a lot. Anyway, exactly. Sig, go ahead, please.
No, I just wanted to interject on that point on MicroStrategy. At least in the UK, that is certainly true that a lot of people do take positions in MicroStrategy because we don't have access to the Bitcoin ETF. And it's also a very tax efficient way of being able to have Bitcoin in your pension or Bitcoin mm-hmm. in the equivalent of your IRA or Roth.
Yep.
Sorry.
Yep.
Yep. That tax vehicle in US, but the equivalent in the UK, which is called NISA. And you can do all of that without actually having to own the underlying asset. And obviously, if in countries which don't have a Bitcoin ETF, like you're waiting, you might get there when Bitcoin's at 120 or 130,000, which you don't want to do. So MicroStrategy is one of the ways that people get exposure. I wanted to ask, given sort of this, you know, how you're talking about conviction coins and non-conviction coins, what's your take on something like the Runes protocol coming to Bitcoin and essentially bringing more non-conviction coins over onto Bitcoin and exposing it to the masses, if you like?
So I think, the interesting debates to me there are, my sort of free marketer bias comes in. I tend to not care about things too much that don't interrupt other people's things, right? So to the extent that, you know, runes or ordinals or whatever is not infringing on other people using Bitcoin as a store of value, like who cares? Is sort of like my base mental state, which is why I think conversations around, for example, fees get more nuanced and more interesting, right? So Anita Posh is a great example of someone who's, you know, primarily focused on Bitcoin in the developing world, right? She spends a lot of time in Southern Africa. And so when she sees, you know, a bunch of ordinals going through and driving fees up, you know, per transaction, she gets stressed out because the use case that is sort of most important to her are people who are transacting on a much smaller basis, who like where the jump between, you know, a 50 cent fee and a $7 fee is actually really meaningful. I think those kind of conversations are good. They're important to have for Bitcoin. By and large, I think that the flowering of people experimenting with things is a good thing. I think there's going to be more of it. I think that, again, it's sort of The whole thing about Bitcoin is that it's sort of the most truly free market that exists. And so, you know, if people find ways to do interesting things with it, you know, they're going to do it. And, you know, they've been largely prohibited from that, one, from an interest standpoint, but two, just because it was not approved by the community. And I think that that's been broken a little bit. And, you know, now there are obviously big debates, but the space is open for experimentation and creativity. You know, to what extent it ends up being a door in for new people to explore the asset, I'm not sure yet. You know, I think that there are certainly uses of these things that I find like more interesting than others. But I don't know. I mostly find myself thinking that it doesn't in any way really infringe upon the piece of Bitcoin that makes me think it's important from a long-term historical perspective. And so have at it, because who knows what might come.
Yeah, great insight. And I want to be mindful of your time. I know you have to go. We could talk to you literally all day. We could go into Bitcoin versus gold. We could go into Bitcoin dominance. We could do a whole hour on AI. Last question. What do you make of Ethereum's price action thus far this cycle versus Bitcoin's and Solana's? I mean, you mentioned that you invest in things besides Bitcoin, the Ethereum's and the Solana's of the world. A lot of people, I think, on the crypto side were ETH permabulls. And I don't know, it's been kind of odd to me watching the price action this cycle. What do you make of it?
I think that of Ethereum has been in an uncomfortable narrative position this cycle so far. It's important to remember and not overstate the case. Like, there are it's not just the perma bulls who are, you know, the sort of like the talkers, you know, like I'm a talker.
Yep.
It's the perma bulls who are builders. Like, those are the perma bulls that matter more. And they have not abandoned this. But when you look at from a narrative perspective, you have on the one hand, sort of like the Bitcoin as the sort of the easiest set of trade-offs between sort of like decentralization and, you know, functionality, right? That's very clear set of trade-offs. And then over on the other hand, you have things like Solana, which are, you know, made different trade-offs than Ethereum. And, you know, in a weird way, I think for some number of Bitcoiners who are not just sort of opposed in general to everything, Solana fits more comfortably next to Bitcoin than something like Ethereum does, which is kind of trying to do it all, right? It's trying to be the sort of store of value, or there's the ultrasound money theme for a while, but it's also trying to be this sort of high performance chain that can do all these different things. Now, of course, like, for people who are really excited about Ethereum, it's because they've taken this layered approach and there's different, you know, different things that happen where, but still, like, from a really dead simple, like, why does this thing exist perspective, it's really hard to be a lot of different things to a lot of different people in a lot of different markets. And I think that that's played out a lot this year, in the sense that, like, Bitcoin's, you know, has been sort of reified in its narrative thanks to, you know, the ETF and sort of the strong focus there. Solana had this incredible resurgence, like we talked about before, which just like naturally led to a lot of excitement there. But I don't know, I wouldn't worry long term. Like, there continues to be like significant, you know, innovations and changes in the Ethereum space. There's still a huge community of people who are building there. It doesn't totally surprise me that its price action has been a little weirder than one might expect. We also are dealing, you know, with the very first question of, we don't really know exactly what the hell we're supposed to think is normal in this part of the cycle, because, you know, at the very least, the cycle has been compressed forward and it is possible that it's just been broken entirely. So.
Yeah, I mean, look, makes a lot of sense. If it was easy to figure this stuff out, then everyone would be a billionaire at this point. And yeah, when I think about Ethereum and the ultrasound money thesis, I was confused by it when it was happening last cycle, but it also does, like you're pointing out, kind of interfere with, well, what is it? If we're going to look at the Bitcoin ETF and the Ethereum ETF, one is gold, one is tech, where does the ultrasound money for Ethereum kind of fit into that? Nathaniel, NLW, thank you so much for joining. Everyone should check out the Breakdown Podcast and the Breakdown Podcast Network, because there's more than one podcast in your network. Where else should people find you, Nathaniel?
At NLW is where I am everywhere. So go on a network, search NLW, and I'll probably be there.
The coveted three character Twitter handle, huge. I would love to have my name, but some guy in Italy has it, at PIO, yeah. But at NLW on Twitter, give him a follow. Some of the best insight you're going to find both on Twitter and on the Breakdown Podcast. Thanks so much for coming on the show today, Nathaniel. Your insight is always welcome. We really appreciate it, and hope you have a good rest of your day, man.
Thank you. I always love being here. Cheers, guys.
Awesome. See ya. Ladies and gentlemen, that's our show. We do the show Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. Eastern time each and every week right here on Twitter Spaces, Apple and Spotify podcasts, YouTube, and X platform video. If you want to watch the video stream, see the visuals, see our faces as we chat, subscribe and like on YouTube. Like and subscribe is how you say it. Anyway, we'll be back tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening.